As a reminder, this event is on the record, and I can assure you that we have journalists in the back of the room covering the event.
Oh, yes, there were, because Fed Chairman Jay Powell gave a big, big speech today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is, I believe, Wednesday, the 28th day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. What we had today in response to that speech that Fed Chair Jay Powell gave was a pretty epic case of what you heard being directly related to what you wanted to hear. Yes, Powell said the economy is fine. He rolled out a new report on financial stability. We're pretty stable, is the upshot. And then he said this about how the Fed's thinking about its next decisions on interest rates, which is really what everybody went to that luncheon for.
We'll be paying very close attention to what incoming economic and financial data are telling us.
People, by which I mean Wall Street, heard that and it was off to the races in the markets because there are some signs, the thinking goes, that the economic data is going to show things are slowing. So that, of course, will mean the Fed is going to stop raising rates. But, well, look, listen to this.
The steps that we take will be data dependent.
Ben Bernanke, 5 years ago, data dependent. And then take a listen to this.
Our actual policy actions over time will be data dependent.
Janet Yellen, 3 years ago, data dependent. So you see what I mean. Powell is a policy guy, but he did come up with some pretty good imagery of what it's like trying to figure out what the data is going to be saying about where our economic future lies.
I liken it to walking into a room full of furniture like this and suddenly the lights go out. So what do? You slow down and you maybe go a little bit less quickly and you feel your way more.
And you see what the data says. So with that as prologue, we're going to dig in a little bit more to what Chair Powell said and what it might mean in actual practice with Dion Rabone. He's at Yahoo Finance and he is every now and then on a Friday here with us. Hey, Dion.
Hey, Kai. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, and thanks for answering the phone when we called this morning. So, look, I'm going to play you another piece of tape from Chair Powell, and then we're going to talk about it. Here he is.
Interest rates are still low by historical standards, and they remain just below the range of estimates of that level that would be neutral for the economy. That is, neither speeding up nor slowing down growth.
Neutral is like nirvana, right? For monetary policy, not too hot, not too slow, just right.
Just right, exactly. Interest rates aren't going to get out of hand. Inflation's not going to get out of hand. You're also going to keep unemployment low. That's the beauty of this thing they call the natural unemployment rate. No one's ever figured out how to quite achieve it, but it's the central banker's holy grail.
Are we getting too excited then? And by we, again, I think I mean traders, but also there will be some euphoria among analysts, and the White House will certainly pick up on this with the stock market doing what it did today. Are we getting too excited that maybe the Fed is actually going to pause?
Yeah, I think we could be, but then again, we might not be. Look, the idea here is, right, I had
great,
to give you a little economist on
that,
the one hand,
great.
On the other hand. No, and look, you have to understand the divergence or the bifurcation, if you will, of the markets, right? Stock traders are kind of like the frat boys of Wall Street. They hear this and they get excited. Hey, it's Fed put time. It's BTFD. Got to buy those dips. We're going to make money. Powell is saying that he is going to put a Fed put in place. What's a Fed put
that,
basically?
Yeah.
Is the idea that if the stock market sells off too much, if it goes too low, the Federal Reserve will step in, lower interest rates, and act as a put, which is essentially insurance for your stock portfolio. So Alan Greenspan kind of introduced this idea years back,
yeah.
And there was a question about whether Jay Powell would continue the Fed put. And what traders saw today when Chair Powell made those remarks, or before he even made them, when they came out in his pre-release comments, was, hey, we got the Fed put, the Powell put. It's time to buy those dips. Stocks are going up.
See, that's so interesting because in another part of his speech today, and I didn't pull this piece of tape because I figured it would be a little too long-winded, but who knew you were going to go there? Powell said, look, he cited an example from history where a previous Fed governor had said, and like in March of 1929, he said, oh, I think we should probably stay away from figuring out what stock prices are going to be. And look what happens in October 1929. So it's hazardous territory for the Fed chair to start messing around with asset values and stock prices.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why he didn't explicitly refer to them. In fact, he did talk about, you know, asset prices, really kind of giving an underhanded nod to the stock market, but didn't really say stocks are going down, so we're doing this, because as you said, that's dangerous territory. Right. But what he did say is that we're close to neutral, which, you know, sort of reversed this comment that he made a couple months ago or last month that we were a long way away from getting the neutral rate, which gave the implication that things have gotten bad in the stock market. And as things have gotten bad in the stock market, that means the Fed is paying attention and is ready to step in and act as needed.
Deanna Rabowan at Yahoo Finance, and every now and then on a Friday, here with us. Thanks, man. Appreciate you coming by.
Hey, always a pleasure.
All right. Be good. There is a really interesting, actually, confluence of macroeconomic events, I guess you'd say, coming to us this week's Powell speech and what the Fed may or may not do. Also, President Trump's meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the G20 this weekend in Argentina and what those two may or may not agree about the trade war. President Trump is talking about bumping up his tariffs on Chinese goods a lot, by the way. China says if things do get worse, it would be a lot worse. So what do you think, though, the American business community is looking for? What is on their holiday wish list out of this meeting and out of the trade war, if you will? And is it something that politicians can deliver? From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong has that part of the story.
For many U.S. companies, the biggest thing they're asking Santa for is to stop the trade war bleeding, freeze or delay tariffs that raise prices and hurt exporters. That'd be progress, says consultant David Hathaway of the Albright Stonebridge Group. But the bigger problems that brought the tariffs in the first place, like protecting American business secrets, they won't be fixed with a fancy communique.
The things that they're really hoping for, better IP protections and greater market access and so forth, are the harder things to get. And those sorts of things are difficult to move into a short-term agreement.
Still, the business lobby is asking for a negotiating framework, rules for meeting, committing, monitoring. See, Beijing is known for letting outside firms in on paper and then, whoops, holding up a business license forever. Aaron Ennis is with the U.S.-China Business Council.
We take it back to a Ronald Reagan approach, and that's trust but verify. All right, you've announced these market openings. Now let's see how many foreign companies get approved.
The other big ask, intellectual property. U.S. firms complain that their ideas and technologies get swiped or forcibly taken in China. Linda Lim teaches international business at the University of Michigan.
They're often required to disclose their intellectual property. There's a feeling that it's leaked to competitors.
One thought is for Beijing to make IP theft a crime. By one estimate, China's lifting of U.S. intellectual property costs $225 billion a year. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as I said, what Chair Powell said and what traders heard were not necessarily the same thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a little bit of this and a little bit of that in housing news today. The Commerce Department told us this morning sales of new homes fell almost 9% in October from a month before. That is the fourth decline in the past 5 months, for those of you keeping track. Rising interest rates, along with higher prices, are dragging down demand for new homes. You could make more homes more affordable, of course, by building more of those homes, that whole supply-demand thing. But with slowing sales, builders don't have a whole lot of incentive to put up more houses, right? And that is the real estate conundrum that we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to look at.
Demand for new homes should be strong. The economy is growing, unemployment is low, and people are finally earning more money. The problem is the low supply. Ben Ayers is senior economist at Nationwide Insurance.
Because there's just so few houses available out there, more and more folks are saying, I'm going to wait off till later to buy a home, either because prices are going up or because the mortgage rates are going up.
Less demand will gradually increase the supply as homes sit on the market longer, but it's also likely to slow the building of new homes even further. Robert Dietz is chief economist with the National Association of Home Builders. He says higher costs for materials and labor are already depressing home construction.
Now that home price growth is going to slow due to rising inventories, it's going to be harder to make up for those higher costs of construction.
One bright spot, though, Dietz says construction of townhouses that are cheaper to build and require less land has been growing by about 20%. Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin, predicts overall home construction will decline next year, but low unemployment and higher wages should boost demand for entry-level homes.
So we think that overall there's going to be fewer homes built, but the homes that do get built will likely be at a more affordable price point.
One big caveat to all the hand-wringing about the softening market, fall is typically a slower time for home buying anyway, and things could look a lot different come spring. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Also in that Commerce Department report today, by the way, the median home price for a new home in this country, about $310,000. So on the theory that real estate is all about location, location, and then location, you can find out where you can buy a house with that price tag, $310,000, at marketplace.org. Tax time next April is going to be interesting, being as it will be the first filing season for which the overhauled tax code will apply. There is a provision of that code that's going to take effect on January the 1st that'll affect people going through a divorce. For more than 75 years in this economy, alimony payments have been tax deductible for the person making the payments and reportable as income for the recipient of alimony payments. As of New Year's, that's not going to be. Unless your divorce is finalized by New Year's Eve, in which case you will be grandfathered in. And all of that is making this a busy season at divorce lawyers' offices, as Marketplace's Mario Segarra reports.
When Heather graduated from the University of Utah, she had these big dreams. She was going to get her MBA and work her way up to the corner office.
But, you know, life gets in the way. Our culture tends to promote young marriage and starting a family young. And that is what we did.
Heather's Mormon. She got married in 1992 and stayed home to raise her four daughters. She asked us not to use her last name because she's in the middle of a divorce.
And at 49 years old, as a woman who has no experience and just a piece of paper that says I have a degree, it's quite difficult to move forward without a little bit of help.
Heather's preliminary divorce agreement, sent over by her husband's lawyer, includes alimony. She says it's not enough for her to live on until she finds a full-time job. But she might accept it, because there's this caveat attached.
That if it is not signed and sealed and delivered, and the judge signs it by December 31st, then the offer is null and void.
That's because for divorces finalized after January 1st, people who pay alimony will no longer be able to deduct it from their taxes. And people who receive alimony won't have to pay taxes on it. Divorce lawyers say clients who would be paying alimony are rushing to finalize their divorces before the change goes into effect. Sandra Radna is a divorce lawyer in New York. Half of her divorce cases involve alimony. And she started hearing from clients as soon as the tax law passed.
Usually started off with a phone call or an email or a text message saying, Sandra, what are we going to do? And we have to be done by the end of the year.
Radna specializes in highly contested divorces.
Highly contested means that we both agree that we want to get divorced, but we're not agreeing on anything. We don't agree on who should have custody of the children. We don't agree on how the assets should be divided up. Maybe one spouse thinks the other spouse is hiding
but
money.
But since clients really don't want to miss the December 31st deadline,
they're willing to maybe concede some issues that they wouldn't have conceded before.
Take the house. Have the retirement account. You want an extra visitation day with the kids? All real examples from Radna's clients. But you can't always come to an agreement. Steve, who also asked us to withhold his last name, is going through a divorce. He's 38, lives in California. He and his wife have two daughters, ages 7 and 9. He earns a lot more money than his wife, so he's gonna owe alimony. Also, they've been married for more than 10 years. Under state law, that means there's no set end date to the alimony payments. So it's possible that
I'm going to pay alimony until I die or until she dies or she remarries.
Steve says this deduction could add up to hundreds of dollars a month or six figures over a lifetime. And he says if he loses it, he'll offer his wife less. So he's been trying to get her to sign the divorce papers before the year ends.
I explained to her that it's beneficial for both of us.
But because they've already split their assets, like their house and rental properties, 50-50.
I didn't actually have any negotiation or any bargaining power in my hand.
Steve says he's still trying to get the divorce settled by December 31st. If that doesn't happen, they might end up in court, where a judge would decide. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Napoleon actually railed against short sellers back in his day.
Had about as much luck at it as you'd think he did, too. First, though, let's us do the numbers. There you go. Dow Industrial's up 617 points. Thank you, Jay Powell. 2.5%. 25,366. The NASDAQ up 208, 2.9%. 7,291. S&P 500 put on 61 points, about 2.2%. 27.43. Industrial stocks are among those often hit hardest by trade wars. Today, though, Boeing found 4.8%. Caterpillar picked up 4.9%. Customer management software maker Salesforce climbed 10.2% today after reporting stronger than expected earnings and revenue. Software maker Adobe rose 7.3%. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.06%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace has a mission that drives what we do every day, to increase economic intelligence across the country. But we can't do it alone. So please, become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount you choose, and your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. While the immigration debate in this country is playing out almost entirely on the southern border, the changes the Trump administration has made to how people are able to enter the United States is affecting what happens on the northern border as well. 2 years ago, there were so few asylum seekers trying to enter Canada from here that the Canadians basically didn't even keep track. Well, they do now. Since February of last year, 37,000 people have crossed into Canada from the United States asking for asylum. A lot of them have wound up in Toronto, where they need food and shelter. And as Marketplace's Emma Jacobs reports, somebody to foot the bill.
I met Louis, an asylum seeker from Nigeria, at a Toronto coffee shop. He asked us to call him only by his middle name to protect his identity. He says he once owned an ad agency, but decided to leave Nigeria to escape religious persecution. He and his family landed in the U.S. earlier this year on a tourist visa. He says with all the changes in U.S. immigration policy, they were discouraged by the prospects of getting asylum there.
I couldn't hold on to anything. It wasn't promising. It was scary.
So in June, they headed to Canada with nothing but the money in his wife's purse. Like many asylum applicants, they turned to Toronto's homeless shelter network for housing. But there was no room. In October, almost 40% of the residents in the system were asylum seekers, more than three times as many as 2 years ago. Louis, his wife, and their three kids ended up in a hotel room paid for by the city of Toronto.
Well, everybody has to wake up when the baby's crying. But God give us a peaceful baby. She doesn't cry so much.
1,700 asylum seekers are currently living in Toronto area hotel rooms. That can cost the city $38 or more per night. The city says it's spent almost $50 million housing refugees and asylum seekers over the past 2 years. The day before Louis and his family arrived in Canada, Toronto's mayor, John Tory, asked the province of Ontario and the federal government for help.
We have exhausted our available sites, our resources, and our personnel.
Officials in Ontario's conservative government say the province has already spent $100 million of its own money on education and welfare payments to the new arrivals. They want the federal government in Ottawa to pick up that tab, and the city's costs, too. They say it's only fair because Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his center-left government have encouraged asylum seekers to come to Canada. James Wallace is a columnist for the conservative Toronto Sun.
It would be irresponsible for anyone to invite someone into their house and then turn around and send them off to the neighbors. And that really is what's happened here.
So far, the federal government has reimbursed just over 5% of the cost. Local governments in Canada are normally responsible for supporting asylum seekers while their applications make their way through the country's immigration system. That's according to Debbie Corrigan, executive director of Sojourn House, which runs two emergency shelters for the city of Toronto. Both are devoted exclusively for asylum seekers. She acknowledges the current influx of applicants is not normal.
all of these people coming has also created a backlog that ultimately can take up to 2 years.
2 years of additional costs in a city where rents are skyrocketing. Nigerian asylum seeker Louis spent 3 months looking for an apartment to live in until the family receives a decision on their asylum claim.
The rents are really crazy. They're scary.
He ended up finding a place outside the city where rents are cheaper. He will have a long commute, though, to his job at a telecom company in Toronto, but he's happy to make the sacrifice. That still leaves thousands of asylum seekers in Toronto shelters for the foreseeable future. And with a nationwide election less than a year away, they're likely to become a campaign issue. In Toronto, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Tesla shares rode the wave on Wall Street today, up a touch more than 1%, which for investors who are hoping those prices keep going up, that was nice. But for what are called short sellers, maybe not so nice. And there are a lot of people selling Tesla short, people who are betting, hoping, really, that the company is not going to make it. Renee Merle covers business for The Washington Post, most recently writing about the tense relationship between Tesla, its CEO Elon Musk, and those short sellers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Do me a favor, first of all, would you, and give the, 30-second explanation of short selling, please.
Short selling is a maneuver used by certain investors to bet against a stock. Basically, what they do is borrow a stock and then sell it in the hopes that they can buy it later at a lower price. And so they can pocket the difference and, you know, make a profit. But if the price of the stock goes up, they lose. They have to cover that, price increase.
Mm-hmm. And we should say here, it is a well-known and recognized strategy on Wall Street, right?
It's well known, well recognized. It's actually been around since the 1600s. Yeah. Napoleon actually railed against short sellers back in his day. So just this maneuver is nothing new.
Well, without comparing him to Napoleon, Elon Musk has also been railing against short sellers. Short sellers love Tesla in that I think you're going to go broke kind of way. So explain what exactly it is that short sellers are looking at when they're looking at Tesla.
One, they just think that General Motors and other established big car makers are eventually going to eclipse Tesla because they're a niche product. They don't believe that Tesla is going to be able to live up to its promises in terms of meeting production goals. Mm. They don't believe that Tesla is going to make enough to pay off some debt that's going to become due in within the next year. So there are a lot of arguments being made that Tesla is either going to go broke or going to have a really hard time.
All right. So we have to go sort of a little bit into Elon Musk's psyche, which is a tricky thing to do, I understand, in a radio interview. But he hates short sellers. That's clear. He hates what they're doing to the company. He hates what they're saying about the company. And then 3-ish months ago, whatever it is, there was that whole thing where he tweeted out he was going to take the company private. He had funding secured. The stock popped just a little bit. And a lot of people saw that as him trying to squeeze the shorts.
Yes, they did, in part because he had been kind of warning the shorts that something bad was about to happen. And so when he put out that tweet, the company stock price increased, and these short sellers lost a lot of money. By some estimates, they lost about $1 billion.
Can we back away from Tesla for a minute here and talk about the function of shorts in the market sort of overall? I mean, if you look at the market as an ecosystem, short sellers have a function. They have an actual role.
They really do. And what short sellers would say is that they're out there looking for problems, either, that a company is overvalued, but also that they're actually a part of a fraud, that there are some fundamental problems with it. Short sellers were the first to identify the problems with Enron. Even their critics acknowledge, even Elon Musk at one time in 2012 acknowledged that short sellers had value, though he now, I think, would deny that.
Has changed that tune. What about, just to get it back to Tesla on the way out here, the folks who have shorted Tesla, at least one of them has given up and said, look, it's not worth the headache to try to keep shorting this company. I'm done.
Yes, he did. And this was somebody who actually had gone after Enron again and bet against the housing crisis. So he had been right on a lot of big things. Hmm. But he looked at Tesla and said, Tesla's shareholders, investors would never believe the problems that he was pointing out. I just can't break through this narrative. Elon Musk has had a stranglehold on this.
Hmm. Renee Merle, she's a business reporter at The Washington Post, writing most recently on Tesla a little bit, but also shorts in the market and what they do. Renee, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, we start with a central banker, we end with a central banker because we are nothing if not consistent on this program. Mark Carney is the governor of the Bank of England. Jay Powell's counterpart over there is one way to think about it. Anyway, the B of E came out with a study today about the various Brexit scenarios, Brexit with a deal with the EU, Brexit with some kind of deal with the EU, and then the hard Brexit, no deal, no nothing, which Carney called reduced openness. Here is his forecast for what happens then.
The direction of the effects of a reduction in openness is clear. Lower supply capacity, weaker demand, a lower exchange rate, and higher inflation.
Or in non-central bank speak, a giant recession. Also, in case you're wondering, yes, the head of the Bank of England is Canadian. Oh, it's a little tight. We're going to have to hustle here. We're leaving. The Dow Industrial is up 617 today, 2.5%. The NASDAQ up 208, 2.9%. S&P 500 up 61, 2.2%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. Look at this. I had all kinds of time. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.